This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
To me, stuff matters. And the things that we're doing, you know, the things that that people look to us for as a parish council, it's important. We've got things that we still want to do. That there is a community here. It does need serving, irrespective of what plans other people have. And maybe the local government reorganisation, when we actually get the details of that, maybe that will give a little bit more power to our elbow. Who knows?
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, we find out why thousands of houses are costing us, the taxpayers, millions. Big Brother is watching you now in Medway, and local MPs called for better protection for leaseholders and freeholders. And our very special guest is a parish council chairman who helped lead a campaign against a massive housing development on his doorstep. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And with me is Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway.
Hello.
And also joining is KM Media Group senior news editor, Nikki White.
Hello.
Dan isn't with us this week, but was at pains to tell us that he's working and not dossing. His words, not mine. First up, Robert, what's happening down in Medway?
Well, with all the new schemes which Medway Council has introduced, such as school streets and red routes, as well as introducing better ways of catching people who break the rules, such as the new AMPR cameras to monitor yellow box restrictions which came online this week, I wondered how many of these fines are actually being paid. I think most of us assume that when a fine is issued, it's eventually paid, but the truth is not quite so simple.
So how many fines are being issued and how many are being collected? And more importantly, how many are uncollected?
Well, between April 2022 and September 2024, just under a quarter of a million fines were issued, including things for educational penalty notices, fines for littering, parking fines and moving traffic offences. Of those, 28% of them, just over 64,000, have not been collected. If they had been collected at the sort of higher rate that they can be charged for, which is listed different for each of the different types of fines, this would mean Medway Council would have an additional £10.5 million.
So what's been done to try and get this back?
Well, collection rates have been improving. For April 2022 to April 2023, 41% of fines issued weren't collected. But more recently, April 24 to September 24, only 18% were missed. Medway Council say they pursue fines issued as much as is appropriate, including sometimes through legal action. What's been happening in your world, Simon?
A large housing scheme in Lenham near Maidstone is set to cost the taxpayer twice as much as was originally thought. Maidstone Borough Council is the lead in the development of the Heathlands alongside the government Quango Homes England. And they hope that the scheme would hit the public purse for about 8 million quid before a single brick is laid. And like all councils in the country, the local authority has to meet government housing targets or face losing its planning powers. The local campaigner, John Britt, who is going to be joining us shortly, says the scheme is just a bottomless pit.
Remind us of the background to the Heathland scheme.
About 6 years ago, Maidstone announced that it would be the developer of 5,000 houses at Lenham Heath. It has government housing targets to meet, and there was a feeling at the time that if you can't beat them, you might as well join them and try and maintain some control over the planning issue. Needless to say, this came like a bolt from the blue to the residents at the time, who have argued consistently that development is in the wrong place, is ill-served by infrastructure and will cost far, far too much money. Anyway, a subsequent planning inspector has decreed that a railway station has to be built in the first phase, the first tranche of houses, which opponents say will make it simply even harder to deliver.
And why is it costing the taxpayer so much?
Well, it's effectively publicly funded development anyway, and so far the costs have amounted to £3 million in running the scheme and just getting it off the ground. And that's projected to rise to 8 million quid. And that bill is split 50-50 with Homes England. So far, Maidstone Borough Council have paid 1.5 million, and now they've just agreed to stump up another 2.5 million to get it to the next phase. A significant chunk of it went on King's Counsel, some of the country's top lawyers, and the cost of the changes made to the project as it has evolved. Now, supporters of Heathland say it would prove to be value for money in the long run, and it will be, and the money that have spent, the 8 million quid, will be recouped when the scheme goes through and the houses come into the market or the land is sold to the developers. John Britt says the collaborators treated the public finances like a bottomless pit, although they insist that the money is recoverable. In the meantime, the ruling Conservatives got the Heathlands project into the local plan and promptly lost the local elections and were replaced by a Green and Liberal Democrat coalition, which are both opposed to the development but were unable to do anything about it since. John Britt, as you'll probably hear in the next few minutes, is pretty sceptical, to say the least, about whether Heathlands will ever see the light of day. And if it fails, those millions of pounds will be lost. So what's happening up at Westminster then, Nikki?
Some Kent politicians are among more than 80 Labour MPs who have signed a letter this week calling for a better deal for leaseholders and freeholders. It's come about after a meeting of 30 of them. They held a meeting with the managing director of Firstport, which is the UK's largest managing agent. The firm has a wide portfolio of properties nationwide, from housing estates and blocks of flats to things that they describe as multi-amenity residential developments. But there's been some complaints from some of the residents about the firm and their concerns over rising management fees and the service that they get in return. Those complaints have been enough to prompt MPs to call a meeting with Firstport's managing director, Martin King. So in the letter that was published this week, which is addressed to Mr. King, the MPs say that over the last few months, many constituents have reported problems with Firstport managed properties, and it's clear the impacts are being felt by tens of thousands of households up and down the country. The letter says that in the meeting, colleagues shared numerous examples of unreasonable service, charge increases, poor performance and a lack of responsiveness from Firstport, as well as issues such as value for money. Now, the MPs say that Firstport acknowledged that it had failed to deliver to the standards leaseholders have a right to expect, and that they were undertaking a programme to improve their treatment of customers and the services they offer, including a review of service charge administration to provide greater clarity, and the launch of a customer listening programme to get daily feedback from residents. That letter laid out seven commitments MPs now want to see Firstport progress with, and that includes senior managers meeting with residents, better communication over any proposed changes, evidence of value for money, and details of what compensation the firm will pay when they get things wrong, so that MPs can then scrutinise whether they feel that that's enough. The MPs have said that they're going to be monitoring the firm closely to ensure they deliver on the pledges that they've made, and they expect to see a clear improvement by the time they meet again.
So who has signed the letter?
From Kent, Jim Dixon, the MP for Dartford, was one of them. He said he'd done it because he felt enough was enough and people deserve better. Also, Lauren Edwards, who represents Rochester and Strood, and Daniel Francis, who is MP for Bexley Heath and Crayford, they also put their names to it, as did Gravesham MP Lauren Sullivan. Now, she said she'd done it after hearing complaints from constituents who live at Springhead Park in Northfleet, especially around unexpected, unreasonable and unexplained increases in their service charges. Of course, it isn't a problem just for people involved with Firstport. It's a story that's going to resonate with many other people whose homes are covered by these contracts. With the leasehold system in England and Wales being overhauled by the end of the current Parliament, this is likely to be a topic that's going to crop up again in the coming months.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Struck off Maidstone Borough Council's Christmas card list many years ago is Joel Britt, who, with others, fought the council's intention to build 5,000 homes on land not so far from his home. The people of Lenham and Lenham Heath proved formidable opponents, as did the Save Our Heathlands campaign group. But ultimately, the campaign was lost, despite valiant efforts of the community to stop it, even in the High Court. But John has never lost the belief that the reality of delivering the scheme will prove its undoing. John Britt joins me now. Thanks for joining today.
Hello. Hello, Simon. Good afternoon. I'm laughing at the Christmas card list.
Did you get a Christmas card from Maidstone Borough Council last Christmas?
No, but I keep getting pains in my back. I think someone's got a little effigy of me that they keep sticking pins into.
Yeah, okay. Well, you probably gave them a pin in the neck, but that's beside the point. When was the first that you knew Maidstone Borough Council had plans for 5,000 houses at Lenham Heath? Can you remember how it happened?
Well, I do. And I think it might have been you that originally broke it at the Downs Mail.
Yeah, I was the editor of the Downs Mail for a few years. And I got a feeling we did, actually.
It was in the air for a while, but in fairness, but we kind of got it confirmed by somebody on the inside at Maidstone Borough Council, and I think we run it on the front page. So it may very well have been that. Yeah.
Yeah. So what? This, I mean, it didn't happen to me, but it was my predecessor, Richard Greenwood.
Yeah.
And he was demanded, he was told that he had to go to a meeting and that he should take the deputy chair of the parish council with him, but nobody else was allowed. And on the way round to the community centre, he called into the paper shop for his copy of the KM, and across the, in a banner headline was 5,000 houses for Lenham Heath. So he kind of like walked round to the community centre, sat down at the table, put it on the table and said to William Cornell, "So I suppose this is what you want to talk to me about." And that's how we found out.
For information, William Cornell is the guy at Maidstone Borough Council who's ultimately in charge of this project. So that's how you find out. So
that's in 2019, I think.
Seems like a very long time ago, doesn't it? Well, you know, what was your reaction when you sort of had it confirmed officially from the horse's mouth?
Well, I think all of us were, and when I say us, so I joined the parish council in 2018 when I retired, and we were up to our necks in regulation, whatever it was, for the Lenham Neighbourhood Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working really closely with officers from Maidstone Borough Council to progress the Lenham Neighbourhood Plan, because that was a requirement from the then 2017 local plan review that we'd have 1,000 houses in Lenham, and we were given the opportunity to create a neighbourhood plan that said where those houses would go and what they'd look like. So I think we were something like regulation 18B or 16B or whatever it was. We were doing public consultations at that time, because that was a requirement of the process that we were going through, was to the members of the public. And they were all saying, well, what about these houses? And of course, we just looked at them as if to say, well, this blindsided us. I think that's not an exaggeration to say. But we decided that we were going to carry on with the Lenham Neighbourhood Plan because we'd gone so far down the road.
Mm.
And that the idea was that it's much better to have a plan that you can rally round than nothing at all.
Mm.
And I suppose that, you know, that still applies.
Well, I mean, leaving the neighbourhood plan to one side, I mean, they're very important to parishes particularly because it was meant to give you some sort of autonomy over, or some kind of control over what was being plonked on your doorstep. And then the local council comes along and says, well, hang on a second, we're going to be behind 5,000 houses and we're basically sort of saying it's going to be on your doorstep. So I mean, that, I can understand how it might have felt a bit galling. But you must have also known that Maidstone Borough Council was up against it because of the government targets, which were probably well in excess of what could be provided, as every council in Kent is. But, you know, you have to put the houses somewhere. So why did you so fundamentally believe that the Lenham Heath, the Heathlands project, was so fundamentally flawed?
So there's two parts to that. The first is that if you look at the data, Maidstone is one of the borough councils, which has consistently over-delivered in terms of housing numbers. It's running at around about 10% above its requirement. So that then influences the next year's requirement, if you follow me. So they're in that respect, they're in a hole of their own digging.
Mm.
And the reason why we thought that Heathlands was so wrong was because before they did that, they decided that they were going to stop this the process of dispersal, which is kind of like building a small numbers of houses
here and there,
here and there, well, around Maidstone and sort of like doing it incrementally.
Mm.
And what they were going to do was to create three large developments, that's Lidsing, something on Invicta Barracks, and then a third one. And in terms of assessing where the third one should go, there was an internal document which looked at five different sites, and the site that came out at the bottom was Heathlands, and the site that came out at the top
was Marden.
Mm-hmm.
But Marden got set aside. Now we can talk about why Marden got set aside. Marden was set aside and suddenly Heathlands was the flavour of the month.
Well, I mean,
that's why we were so irritated.
Okay, I understand that. And I don't want to rehearse the whole Marden argument because the people from that area are not here to put their side. But I do remember, in fairness, that a lot of the people within the Conservative administration thought that Lennon was good because there were two independent councillors down there and they didn't think, and it was far enough away from everywhere else, not that it felt as if it was something that they could get through, essentially.
Well, you might think that I couldn't possibly.
Okay.
I mean, yes, that's exactly it. It's like, dump it there. I think that is... That is, and we don't, you know, if you speak to people around here, they'll say, well, why here? You know, it's in the middle of nowhere. So if you're going to put 5,000 houses, how are people going to get to where they need to go? So what you have to remember, of course, is that the original proposal included a motorway junction.
Yep.
Well, National Highways wrote a letter and said, look, we don't interrupt our national network to satisfy the needs of housing development. That kind of like put that one on the hold. Then there was going to be a railway station on the high speed line. Well, the whole point about high speed trains is that they don't stop, you know. So what everybody was left with was this kind of like, well, we want to do it there, so let's cobble together some kind of argument that makes it look feasible. And that is what we've been working with since all of this started, is dealing with the cobbled together ideas, which it kind of like uncosted, and actually, are they ever going to be delivered?
I mean, this is part of the so-called sort of garden community, garden village concept, where a developer, in this case it's Midstone Borough Council, comes up with a scheme in an area which is not currently overdeveloped, which the Lenham area isn't, and which serves the purpose of providing a large, block of housing, which satisfied the housing needs over a number of years for the local authority to meet their government targets. You know, I mean, you do accept there is a housing shortage.
So I accept that there's an issue with housing. I think what I would say is that there's actually an affordability a crisis of affordability. If you look at what's currently on sale here from the new developments in Lenham, the majority of stuff that you know, and I'm only looking at Lenham. I'm not looking anywhere outside of here. I'm just looking at what, you know, what's going on in the developments which we know are happening within the Lenham neighbourhood plan. So the price of the average house that's for sale, a new build, is $500,000. Okay. Now, obviously, there's an element of affordability, 40% affordability included in that. But the houses that are for sale, in other words, those that don't meet the criteria for social housing, the houses that are for sale are at $500,000. Now, if you want to rent something in Lenham, a two-bedroom flat in Lenham is nearly £1,000 a month. Now, so I would suggest that, yes, that one of the reasons that there's a housing crisis is because there's a crisis of affordability.
I think that's definitely been echoed by a lot of councils across the South East and in London.
The reason that the £500,000 houses get built is because they're the ones that make a profit. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, house building shouldn't make a profit, but it's how many 4- and 5-bedroom houses does one area need?
But the thing is that they're selling all across the
borough. They're not at the moment. If you just look at what's going on in Lenham, it's slowed down significantly. And a number of, I mean, obviously we're in touch with the developers who are aligned to the Lenham neighbourhood plan. I'm sorry I keep referring to that, but it's what I know about. So we're talking to the developers who are aligned to the Lenham neighbourhood plan.
And you're a Lenham Parish Council chairman. So let's just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we understand from them, you know, that actually, okay, we're going to start this development. We're not going to start it until so-and-so because the market's not right. By the time these houses come to market, we're hoping that it will have turned around and we will have, you know, they're delaying the second and third phases of the houses that they were, you know, that initially they were going to build because the economics environment in which they're going to have to sell those houses isn't right.
Mm.
So I don't think it's fair to say that, oh, well, houses are selling. Well, yeah, I'm sure some are. But what we're told from the developers is that actually it's quite slow at the moment.
Yes, it's quite slow in terms of building new ones because, A, the materials have gone up in price enormously. They can't get the skilled labour at the minute for whatever reason. And just the economic climate generally isn't conducive to sell them even when they've got them. So I take your point, but generally speaking, the houses that you see built in and around Maidstone, I know this and in other areas as well, is that they sell, and they sell quite often to a large proportion of them to people coming from London. You can cash in your two-bedroom flat in Balham and buy yourself a four-bedroom hacienda somewhere near Hawkins or somewhere and still have some money left over. It's a fact. But that's where the market is.
Hawkins. Mm. Yeah. But I think that this is kind of like, we might touch on this later, but one of the things that I feel is that Kent is overheating in terms of the housing market. If you stand back and take a helicopter view at what's being proposed around Kent, so, you know, outside of here, we've got the 5,000 houses at Heathland, you've got 10,000 houses at Otterpool Park, you've got 10,000 houses just off the A20 at Tainham. That's currently in discussion. Then there's another 2,500 houses at Faversham on the Duchy land. And then they're just down in East Kent around Birchington. You know, there are plans to build between 5,000 and 10,000 houses around of the existing settlements there. So you're talking about a significant number of new dwellings that are either already in the pipeline or have already been approved that are going to happen.
But there is also the argument that if you build lots and lots of houses, eventually the market will become saturated and the prices will come down. But that hasn't happened yet.
No, I can. If you can tell me a time when that's happened, I'll gladly listen to you, Simon.
Yeah, well, I'm no expert, so that's why I have people like you on.
Since the war, you know? So I think that people often say this, but In practicality, I don't think it ever happens.
You know, as you just mentioned, the Heathlands is certainly not going to be the last housing development in your part of Kent. Can you see Smarden, which has escaped so far, being considered?
Well, I think everywhere is at risk. And I certainly think that the local government reorganisation, which will remove some of this very local influence that's been able to be exerted or potentially been able to be exerted, start to dissipate. I think that people will start to take a look at a bigger picture. But one of the issues that we have is that we are sandwiched between the M20 and the M2. So there is an M20, M2 corridor along which significant development has taken place.
And yeah, it makes the argument so much more compelling, doesn't it? And you know, do you think that we've got a new government 6 months ago? Angela Rayner and Sir Keir Starmer have made it pretty plain that they want to loosen the planning controls, and that will probably come as a result of the devolved government as well. So, if anything, they want to have the flexibility to build as many as they can.
I've seen the examples. So they're talking about five new cities, aren't they? And most of those are north of London.
Mm.
So like a new Welwyn Garden city.
Yeah, gotcha.
I think that, I mean, in Kent also, there's a significant development going on at Ebbsfleet.
Absolutely, that's huge. Yeah, yes, enormous.
That's huge. But that's an interesting case in point, because originally that was supposed to be finished by now, and they're still developing the infrastructure's taken longer. the actual sale of the properties or the ability to create and then move the properties on has also slowed down. And I think that, you know, again, that was a grandiose plan, and it's I've driven around it, and it's kind of like, whoa, you know, and that is occupied, I suspect, by lots of people who've moved out from London, who see Dartford or Ebbsfleet as countryside.
Oh, absolutely. My colleague and I, Gabriel Morris, did a piece just before the election up in Dartford, and people were talking about having moved from Streatham or South Norwood into the delightful surroundings of Dartford, thinking it was some sort of rural idyll. You know, it was bizarre, but certainly they felt as if Kent was a lot safer, a lot more pleasant place to live than South London was, to be honest with you. But John, you said to me many, many times, even before Heathlands got the go-ahead, that you just didn't believe that was going to happen. Tell me why.
Because I think it's going to be too expensive to do. I honestly, if you look at where they want to put it, there is absolutely every single piece of infrastructure is going to have to be created. So it's not like Ebbsfleet, for example, where Ebbsfleet is adjacent to a 6-lane trunk road. It's on several railway lines. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Everything from the water treatment works through to the roads, the schools, everything,
and the railway station
has to
be built as part of phase one, doesn't it?
It does, and therein lies the tale. So I think that everything is in this kind of like long plan. And at the beginning of it, we're being asked to some kind of like rubber stamp the proposals for it without any idea whether these boxes that are required to be ticked will ever be delivered. And there are examples, again, in Kent, where people have ticked the box to get something over the line, and then when it actually comes to delivering it, it's kind of like, oh no, that's too difficult or too expensive, we can't do that now.
Yeah,
and then you're stuffed. What I really am concerned about, and I know I've said to you, is that the worst outcome of all of this is that we'll have an orphaned housing estate in the middle of nowhere where everybody has to rely on a car, and that will be the worst of all worlds for anyone.
Yeah. John, ultimately, the battle is over for you, as it is in Lidsing, up at the other end of the borough. You know, how's the whole exercise, the battle, left you feeling?
Shafted.
Really?
Yeah, shafted. It's been a process of people making disingenuous comments. I'm just going to say this because I've said it to you before. We're constantly reminded that if something it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And all of the stuff that we heard, and I sat through every single session at the local plan inquiry. The things that I heard, they were just putting sticking plasters over everything because the detail just wasn't there. As a former local government officer, one of the things that I had drums into me in the early stages was you need to be on top of the detail because things will float or sink by the amount of detail you're able to include. And now we're being told, oh, you don't need to worry about the detail. Somebody else will deal with that further down the line. And I think, actually, no. We need to be assured that someone has thought about this detail and how much it's going to cost and who's going to pay for it. Because I don't want in a few years' time, I mean, I've shuffled off this mortal coil by then, but but I don't want in a few years' time to say, why didn't people think about that when they were looking at this? My reputation as someone who actually speaks their mind is very much on the line here. And so I fully intend to keep rattling that cage.
I also asked you in a recent interview, I said, you've got the prospect of 5,000 houses on your doorstep, whether you think they're going to actually happen or not, but I mean, the fact is that the plan's been approved.
And do you think you'll move on?
Oh, that's a bit... I mean, the answer to that is I shouldn't think so. I hate moving. I've still got boxes here that I didn't open 20 years ago. Yeah. When we moved 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But you also said that the reason to stay is because stuff matters.
Yeah, it does. To me, maybe I'm naive in that respect, and I'm perfectly prepared to admit naivety in that aspect. To me, stuff matters. And the things that we're doing, you know, the things that that people look to us for as a parish council, it's important. We've got things that we still want to do. There is a community here. It does need serving, irrespective of what plans other people have. And maybe the local government reorganisation, when we actually get the details of that, maybe that will give a little bit more power to our elbow. Who knows?
John Britt, thank you so much for your time today. Keep in touch and all the best.
Simon Finney, you are more than welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. Cheers. If Kent is chosen by the local government minister, Jim McMahon, to be put on the fast-track priority programme to devolution, we're likely to have an elected mayor in little over a year's time. There's already a fair amount of speculation about who is likely to be the candidates for each of the parties, but we were chatting earlier about the profile of such a candidate and how we make the selection of a mayor more palatable to the younger generation and who might be more engaged. Nikki, what do you reckon?
It's one of those things that it is fairly new, particularly for us down here south. We've heard lots of talk of mayors and things happening in other parts of the country, but to most people down here, this doesn't touch our lives. So it's going to be a kind of real opportunity maybe for somebody new to come in with a completely different outlook on politics, whether that be from age, gender, ethnic minorities. This could be a real opportunity for somebody to drive forward with a different agenda from what most people see as the regular politician. But if you do that, you've obviously got to balance that as well with somebody who is going to be in charge of many, many important things. And they've got to have some kind of experience behind them. Bringing in somebody who is completely new to this kind of job, it's making sure that you get that balance really between the fresh ideas and a fresh drive and a different approach, but also making sure that somebody's got that experience to kind of carry it through take on that responsibility as well. I mean, it's not going to be an easy job.
You can't be 27 and walk into a job like that necessarily, because you simply won't have been able to rack up the experience necessary to be able to run what's effectively a county the size of a small country.
No, maybe not. Age shouldn't necessarily make that a no, because you never know. There are people out there who may be the person who's absolutely perfect for that job, whether they're 27 or 57. But yeah, finding that balance is going to be hard. But I think it really sets up a great opportunity to perhaps tackle things from a completely different viewpoint.
It's interesting, actually, because there was a bit of polling by Ipsos a little while ago, after the general election, and this is, I'm talking about the youth vote, that 77% of the 18 to 24 year olds tended to lean left, Labour, Lib Dems and the Green Party, and 70% of the 25 to 34 year olds also voted for the left wing parties. But I'm not convinced that the young people in Kent actually really do take part in local elections. And I think that because this is a new role, it might be more attractive if the candidates list looked a bit younger.
Yeah, or perhaps less political. I think people might come out and might be a bit more engaged if they feel that they're looking at that role not as somebody who is in charge of it politically, but they are going to be the person who can actually make a big difference in their day-to-day running of their lives. Delivering to people how important this job is and how important it is that we get it right when we go and vote and put our X in the box. It's going to be a tough job. But I think if you just explain to people that this person is going to be the person who's going to have pretty much a really massive influence over your life, they might come out and vote.
That. I don't think people kind of grasp that this whole local government reform and the mayoral office sitting on top of it it's going to be given significantly greater powers than the Kent has ever had before. So the enormous amount of weight of responsibility is obviously going to require someone who's got a fairly long CV. I mean, look at Andy Burnham. He was cabinet minister before he took over Greater Manchester, and he's done a good job there. He's been and very well regarded by people from all sides. Just going to bring you in, Rob. What about the big ticket services that are coming down the line, something like transport? How do you think that might change in terms of the governance in Kent?
Well, I think it's I think to add on to what we've been saying, it's definitely a big opportunity because, as you say, there's lots of areas that this new mayor will be responsible for which have not been powers that have been in Kent. I mean, a couple of examples. Obviously, all councils deal with planning, but the mayor will be in charge of sort of strategic development strategy, looking across the whole of Kent, so there's not sort of big developments on the edge of boundaries that are affecting both sides, you know, that isn't really considered.
They have a bigger overview of all the big stuff.
Yes.
The Ebbs Fleet, for example, you know, that would come under that.
Absolutely.
That, yeah. Or and if there was a major infrastructure change as well. Yeah.
Similarly, they're also going to be responsible for local industry strategies, making sure that sort of people within Kent would be, you know, how do you get them into work? How do you stimulate the economy? And particularly there's an element around job centres and where they go and how efficient they can be, and a more bespoke version of that. On transport, as you mentioned, there's a whole raft of things. I think that's probably the big ticket item. There's lots of different elements of that. They'll be in charge of making sure that main roads are prioritised for keeping them up in good nick. And I think something that Kent people will be quite pleased with is they may get a power to charge companies that want to dig up the road on busy roads at busy times. That's a power that they may gain. Similarly, the rail networks, again, that sort of big picture strategy of what sort of rail improvements does Kent need? Where are the areas that are, you know, best going to be serviced? And they will be sort of that overarching view. Similarly with buses as well. And I think, you know, we're talking about sort of who could fill into that role, who would be a good person to sort of galvanise support for this. And I think this is a really good opportunity in the sense of if... I think there's certain people who will look at this and assume, oh, it's just the same old thing, it's just a new title, another layer of bureaucracy. If there can be sort of a convincement of people that, no, this isn't the same as what's gone before, this is something new, and we'd like to, you know, make the most of it, get somebody dynamic in there who's actually got some fresh ideas, then I think, you know, you could see a lot of people engaging with it and voting more so than they probably do at the moment in council elections.
Yes, and I think that young people want to perhaps see people who look a bit more like themselves. You know, much of local government is in Kent, as is true in a lot of places, is very sort of older, male and white. I mean, that's just especially in the southeast. And if you want to engage young people, perhaps that's not the kind of candidate you'd be looking for. Mm. But equally, by the same token, as I said earlier, a 27-year-old doesn't have a CV that maybe a 42-year-old has. It's finding that balance of the right person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's possibly also about that person maybe making it clear who the team around them is. So we might end up with somebody who is pretty established in politics already, but has an open mind to changing things and taking things in a new direction, but then making clear that they will have a team behind them that perhaps don't have the experience but do have the fresh ideas and you know, but also other people involved who have that experience too. So if you could get a good mix, who knows?
I think also just you mentioned earlier about sort of being almost apolitical, not having that political baggage with you. I think one of the things which Andy Street, the former West Midlands mayor, and Andy Burnham in Manchester have both said is one of the things that they've learnt to appreciate and have gained from this new role rather than being in, say, Parliament, is it's you have to work with the other side. You know, there's all these different councils of different political stripes. And at the end of the day, they kind of realised, oh, we're all trying to do the best for our area. So what does it matter if you wear a different coloured rosette from me? And so I think that will be a real benefit in, you know, not so harsh party lines. If somebody can get in there and say, look, you know, I just want the best for Kent. Do you want the best for Kent? Let's work together. I think that'd be a really positive thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's hope they're listening. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thanks to Rob, Nikki, and our special guest, John Britt. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch The Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.